Welcome to the deep dive. We've got a really fascinating stack of sources today.
Yeah, a huge mix of stuff. Historical research, internal corporate memos, deep dive industry analyses.
Right. And our mission today is to just comb through all this material to uncover the hidden history of Columbia Records.
Which is, I mean, it's a massive
Oh,
story.
absolutely. But we aren't just going to like rattle off a list of famous artists here.
Right.
We are looking at the oldest surviving brand in recorded sound. And to set the stage for you, I want you to imagine you are the biggest rock band on the planet.
Okay, pretty good place to be.
Right. It's 1980. You have this massive chart-topping smash hit with Another Brick in the Wall.
Oh, yeah, Pink Floyd.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You are literally selling out arenas in Los Angeles to absolute rave reviews, and yet local LA radio completely refuses to play your song.
Which makes zero sense.
Total, absolute blackout.
It sounds like, the plot of a corporate thriller or something.
It really does. And the crazy part is, the reason you're blacked out isn't because the radio stations don't like the music.
Right.
It's because your own record label intentionally triggered this shadow war with a mafia-like syndicate of music promoters.
Using your hit song as the bait.
Yes! Using your hit song as bait.
Well, that was the stark reality for Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
But that 1980 crisis didn't just happen in a vacuum.
No, of course not.
To understand Columbia's willingness to fight a shadow war that could have, I mean, easily destroyed their own artists, you have to look at their corporate DNA. You really have to trace this company all the way back to the 19th century to establish a baseline. Yeah, we're going back to 1887. And the founder of the Columbia Phonograph Company wasn't a musician. He wasn't an audio engineer. He was actually a stenographer and a lawyer named Edward D. Easton.
And based on the research, he and his investors essentially set up shop with a local monopoly, right?
Yeah, exactly.
They were selling Thomas Edison's phonographs, plus those really early phonograph cylinders. It's down in Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Delaware, which incidentally is where the name Columbia comes from, the District of Columbia.
It's so funny to think about. The foundation of the modern music industry started as a regional franchise operation for office dictation equipment.
That is wild. But,
Okay.
relying on someone else's technology, especially someone as famously difficult as Thomas
Oh,
Edison.
yeah. Very volatile.
Right, it creates a terrible business model. So by 1894, the relationship completely fractures. Columbia severs ties with Edison entirely.
And when you build your entire revenue stream on someone else's proprietary hardware, and then you just walk
You're
away,
in trouble.
you're in huge trouble. Your survival depends on building a better mousetrap. They literally had to innovate the physical format itself.
So initially, Columbia manufactured these brown wax XP cylinders.
Right, which were a nightmare.
Yeah, to understand the physical limitations here, imagine trying to store and transport hollow tubes of soft, incredibly fragile wax.
They wore out so fast.
And they broke if you looked at them wrong. By 1903, they upgraded to a harder black wax.
But the real existential threat was coming from a rival, right? The Victor Talking Machine Company.
Yes, exactly. They were pushing these flat disc records invented by Emil Berliner.
And discs were infinitely easier to store than those bulky cylinders.
Cheaper to ship, too.
Yep. So Columbia realized their cylinder business was functionally obsolete.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because in 1908, Columbia does something that fundamentally changes how human beings consume media.
It's a huge moment.
They figure out the mass production mechanics of stamping a 10-inch shellac disc with grooves on both sides, not just one.
The double-faced discs.
Right? They call them double-faced discs,
Yeah.
and they sold them for 65 cents. I mean, think about that for a second. That is the physical equivalent of inventing tabs in a web browser.
Huh. That's a great way to put it.
Suddenly, you are getting twice the content, twice the audio, in the exact same physical footprint. It's literally the birth of the B-side.
What's fascinating here is why this matters on a macro level, Before the double-faced disc, a record was this cumbersome, expensive novelty.
You'd listen to a single brief recording.
Right. Carefully put the fragile disc away, and that was it. The friction of the experience completely outweighed the entertainment value.
Oh, for sure.
So by putting music on both sides and heavily marketing their own internal horn player, the Graphinola, to compete with Victor's Victrola, Columbia turned audio from a scientific novelty into a highly competitive, consumer-friendly commodity.
They really forced the whole industry to step up.
They did. They forced everyone to give the buyer more value for their money just to stay relevant.
That mechanical revolution really secured their place in the market, but you know, shifting consumer habits and technological innovation cannot save you when the global economy completely collapses.
No. The transition into the 1930s was just brutal.
I can imagine.
A phonograph goes from being this fun living room centerpiece to an entirely unjustifiable luxury when millions of people are struggling to just afford basic groceries.
Yeah, the economic mechanics of the Great Depression meant discretionary spending on entertainment just evaporated.
The entire recorded sound industry was effectively hollowed out.
Looking at the timeline, Columbia actually went into receivership earlier in 1922, but by 1934, it is a total bloodbath.
Absolute bloodbath.
Their parent company at the time, Grigsby Grunau, goes under. The once mighty Columbia label is liquidated and sold off to the American Record Corporation, or ARC, for a mere $70,000.
Keep in mind, $70,000 for a company that just a decade prior was dictating the global format of recorded sound.
It's crazy.
The decline was so steep that by late 1936, Columbia essentially discontinued its mainstream pop releases.
Wow!
Yeah, the traditional business model of recording large, expensive pop orchestras was just dead.
But if the pop model is dead, they must have found a completely untapped, highly efficient demographic to keep the presses running. Because, you know, the company didn't fold.
They pivoted to grassroots, regional music, with virtually zero overhead.
Okay.
In 1936, they signed a Southern gospel group called the Chuck Wagon Gang.
The Chuck Wagon
yeah.
Gang.
This wasn't glamorous coastal pop music, but this group goes on to sell at least 37 million records.
Wait, 37 million?
Millions.
Mm-hmm.
And the mechanism for that success was a localized radio show hosted by a broadcaster named J. Basil Mull, who aggressively pushed the records to a deeply loyal rural audience.
That's incredible.
The Chuck Wagon Gang single-handedly generated the cash flow keeping the Columbia name alive during his darkest financial hour.
And while that regional gospel music was patching the holes in the balance sheet, the actual physical survival of the company was coming down to sheer grit on the factory floor in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
This is a great part of the story.
This is the part of the research that completely blew my mind. In 1935, a shipping clerk named Herbert M. Greenspan leads a committee to organize the very first trade union shop at Columbia's main manufacturing plant. He gets elected as the president of the local CIO union, and he negotiates the first contract between the factory workers and Columbia management.
Greenspan's trajectory is just remarkable. He stayed with the company for 30 years.
Yeah.
And he ultimately retired as the executive vice president of Columbia Records.
Wait, I have to push back here because the math on this is crazy.
How so?
How does an 18-year-old shipping clerk have any leverage to negotiate a union contract at a collapsing factory? I mean, in an industry that is hemorrhaging money, right in the middle of a massive global depression, where does that bargaining power come from when management could theoretically just fire him and hire anyone off the street?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, survival during that specific economic era wasn't about traditional corporate leverage.
Yeah.
It relied on logistical necessity.
Meaning what, exactly?
Management was incredibly desperate to keep the presses running for whatever meager orders they had coming in, like those high-volume Chuck Wagon Gang records.
Okay.
The margins were razor thin. So an 18-year-old who intimately understands the mechanics of the shipping floor, who controls the flow of physical product out the door, and who has the charisma to unify a frightened, desperate workforce.
He suddenly becomes essential.
Exactly. He becomes the most vital gear in the machine. It was a symbiotic desperation.
Wow.
Management realized any work stoppage would instantly bankrupt the company. They needed him just as much as he needed the paycheck.
So they scraped their way through the decade. And by 1938, William S. Paley of the Columbia Broadcasting System, CBS, buys the Columbia label for $750,000.
A nice little markup from $70,000.
Right. Paley starts injecting real broadcast money back into the company. During the 1940s, they signed Frank Sinatra.
Huge get.
Sinatra records over 200 songs for them, which absolutely stabilizes their revenue stream.
Yeah, he kept them afloat.
And because they finally have a healthy bank account again, they decide to marshal their resources to solve what is basically a first-world listening annoyance.
Oh, the invention of the long-playing record.
Yeah.
The LP. This massive technological leap was driven almost entirely by the personal frustration of Columbia's president at the time, Edward Wallerstein.
Tell me about Wallerstein.
Well, Wallerstein was a massive classical music fan, and the dominant format of the era was the 78 RPM record, made of an abrasive shellac compound.
Which didn't hold much music.
No, The physical limitation of a 12-inch 78 RPM disc was that it could only hold about 4 or 5 minutes of audio per side.
Meaning you literally could not listen to an entire movement of a symphony without the music cutting off abruptly.
Exactly that. You'd get a few minutes in, the orchestra would swell, and then you'd have to physically get up off your couch, stop the heavy tone arm, flip the fragile shellac disc over, sit back down, and try to recapture the mood.
That sounds awful.
It completely ruined the immersion of classical music.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Wallerstein is essentially the godfather of the skip intro button, or like the autoplay feature on modern streaming platforms.
Okay, totally.
He marshaled the entire engineering might of CBS, specifically their research director, Dr. Peter Goldmark, and an audio engineer named William Savory, to cure the physical friction of the listening experience.
Yep.
He just wanted to chill in his living room and listen to a symphony without getting up to flick a disc.
It's a perfect analogy.
Yeah.
The goal was uninterrupted immersion.
Right.
So Goldmark and his team developed the 3313 RPM Microgrooves record made of a new material. Vinyl.
The vinyl.
Vinyl allowed for much narrower, more tightly packed grooves than brittle shellac, and the slower rotation speed meant you could suddenly fit over 20 minutes of high fidelity audio on a single side.
Amazing.
So in June 1948, Columbia officially introduced the LP. And fittingly, the very first classical LP they released was Nathan Milstein playing the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto.
Finally fulfilling Wallerstein's dream of an uninterrupted movement.
Exactly.
And the pop division wasn't far behind. They took an album Frank Sinatra had previously released as a bulky, literal book containing four separate 78 RPM records.
Which is called The Voice of Frank Sinatra.
Right. And they reissued it as a single 10-inch LP. That specific release is arguably the first genuine concept album in pop history.
Oh, definitely.
And it only exists because the physical format now allowed for a continuous thematic listening experience.
This single technical shift was just a watershed moment for the industry. The Microgroove LP effectively killed the classical 78 RPM record overnight.
Wow, just overnight.
Pretty much. For the first time in nearly 50 years, Columbia had established a commanding technological lead over their old rival, RCA Victor.
Oh, Victor must have hated that.
They were scrambling. It completely forced RCA to invent the 7-inch 45 RPM record just to have a proprietary format to compete in the singles market.
That puts Columbia in an incredibly dominant position. The 1950s roll around and they just own the LP market.
Dominating high fidelity pop and jazz.
Right. They've got Duke Ellington. They have Dave Brubeck releasing Time Out. They have Miles Davis putting out Kind of Blue. The label is generating massive wealth and absolute cultural prestige.
They are on top of the world.
But looking at the internal memos from that era, that wealth seemed to breed a really dangerous kind of institutional arrogance.
It did. It created a massive, almost fatal blind spot.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They became the most successful non-rock record company of the 1950s, and that was largely directed by their head of A&R, Mitch Miller.
Who was it?
Miller was a classically trained oboist. He was deeply entrenched in traditional pop and jazz orchestration, and he famously vocally loathed rock and roll.
Oh, no.
He thought it was a crude, noisy fad.
He hated the sound so much that he actively turned away the future of music. In 1955, Columbia actually had the opportunity to buy Elvis Presley's contract from Sun Records.
Yeah, that's a tough one to read.
They submitted a bid of $15,000. But because Miller had zero passion for the genre, when Elvis's manager, Colonel Tom Parker, turned down their initial offer, Columbia just shrugged and walked away.
Just let him go.
They let RCA Victor scoop up Elvis, entirely missing the biggest youth revolution in musical history because of a classical bias.
And they spent the late 50s and early 60s just scrambling to correct that massive miscalculation.
I bet.
Their legendary talent scout, John Hammond, was pushing hard to modernize the roster. He signed Bob Dylan in 1961.
Right.
But initially, Dylan's acoustic debut didn't sell well at all. Columbia executives actually mocked the signing, referring to Dylan as Hammond's folly, and they actively wanted to drop him from the label.
You're kidding. Drop Bob Dylan.
Hammond and Johnny Cash had to fiercely defend Dylan just to keep him in the building.
Which leads to the bizarre story of how they broke Simon and Garfunkel.
Oh, this story is wild.
So the duo records a quiet acoustic track called The Sound of Silence. Their debut album flops, they break up, and Paul Simon moves to the UK to play folk clubs.
Right.
While he is out of the country, a Columbia producer named Tom Wilson decides to secretly pull the master tape of The Sound of Silence and add an electric rhythm section, drums, and bass without telling the band.
Yeah, Tom Wilson was noticing the massive chart success of the folk rock sound popularized by the Byrds. He recognized that the acoustic track had a great melody, but it lacked the driving beat that radio stations were demanding.
So he just changed it.
He just brought session musicians into the studio and overlaid the rock instruments onto the existing acoustic track.
That is insane.
It became a surprise. Number one hit in late 1965. Paul Simon literally found out he had a hit pop record by reading the music press while in England.
Okay, I have to jump in here because this is just baffling to me. Think about the modern equivalent.
Sure.
It's like a producer taking your quiet, intimate, indie acoustic demo, slapping a heavy EDM bass drop on it while you're asleep in another country.
Right.
And you wake up to find out you're globally famous for a sound you didn't even create.
It's an incredible violation of creative intent.
Exactly. How does an artist even process that kind of loss of control? Mm-hmm. I mean, sure, it made them rich and launched a legendary career, but the label basically hijacked their art to chase a trend.
It perfectly illustrates the mechanical desperation of the label at that time.
Yeah.
They were throwing spaghetti at the wall to catch up in the rock era. The corporate mindset wasn't focused on artistic purity. It was purely about clawing back market share from labels that had understood rock from the beginning.
Right, right.
You see this exact same desperate approach peak in 1967 when Clive Davis takes over as president.
Right. Clive Davis attends the Monterey Pop Festival, sees the absolute seismic shift in youth culture, and pivots the label hard into the counterculture, signing Janis Joplin.
He signs the right acts, but the corporate machinery still didn't really understand how rock culture operated.
No.
Look at the disaster of Moby Grape.
Oh, yeah.
Davis signs this incredible San Francisco band in 1967. But instead of letting the band build an organic following, Columbia's marketing department decides to flex their financial muscle.
What did they do?
They released the band's debut album and five separate singles from that album on the exact same day, June 6, 1967.
Which is a catastrophic misunderstanding of how hype and radio programming actually work.
Totally backwards.
You can't flood the market with five singles from an unknown band simultaneously. Radio DJs don't know which track to push, the audience gets overwhelmed, and the songs just cannibalize each other's chart momentum.
The mechanics of the stunt guaranteed failure. Almost all of the singles totally failed to chart.
Of course they did.
The best performing track, Omaha, only reached number 88 and vanished in 3 weeks. Columbia burned their entire promotional budget on an arrogant marketing stunt they never attempted again.
But despite the missteps, as the 1960s bled into the 1970s, that aggressive pivot eventually worked.
It did.
Columbia caught up. They started making astronomical amounts of money from rock bands. But that massive influx of cash didn't just pad their bank accounts. It fueled a kind of technological paranoia.
Yeah, they were always looking over their shoulder.
They were desperate to reinvent the physical record again before a competitor did.
And that paranoia leads us to quadraphonics.
My boy.
In the early 70s, Columbia decides stereo sound isn't enough. They try to push a four-channel audio process using a skew matrix.
Explain the mechanics of that because it sounds incredibly convoluted.
It was an audio engineering nightmare for the average consumer. The skew matrix wasn't just true four-channel sound. It encoded four distinct audio channels down into a standard two-channel vinyl groove.
Oh, okay.
To hear it properly, the listener had to buy a specialized, expensive decoder to split the signal back out.
And then you had to perfectly position four separate speakers in the four corners of your living room.
Which is a fundamental disconnect from how human beings actually live.
Yeah, nobody's living room is perfect.
The engineers built something beautiful in a pristine acoustic lab, but in a real 1970s living room with a couch in the way and odd-shaped walls, it was an absolute mess.
I can imagine.
Artists like Pink Floyd, Billy Joel, and Carlos Santana recorded heavily layered albums using the tech, but it just confused consumers.
It's just too much work for the listener.
RCA released a competing, entirely incompatible four-channel system, and the whole format war just collapsed into a commercially disappointing mess.
And that expensive technological failure was happening right as the global economy shifted again. We hit a severe financial crisis in the late 1970s.
Right.
The entire music industry goes into a brutal slump. Total sales drop by 11%. Columbia lays off hundreds of employees. And to manage this crisis, you have a massive clash of two very different personalities at the top of the company.
Yes. In one corner, you have the president of Columbia Records, Walter Yetnikoff.
Okay.
Yetnikoff is the quintessential 1970s record executive. He was described by contemporaries as wild, menacing, crude, tone-deaf to the actual music, and incredibly loud.
Quite the character.
He was famous for literally shattering glassware in his office to make a point and spewing barnyard epithets at his staff.
And in the other corner, you have Dick Asher, the deputy president.
The total opposite.
Asher was brought in by the CBS CEO specifically to cut the bloat and restore profits. Asher was an experienced media lawyer. He was meticulous, cautious, and viewed by the extravagant A&R staff as a total bore who took away their corporate limousines.
Well, as Asher's digging through the accounting books, trying to find where the company is hemorrhaging cash, he uncovers something deeply alarming.
What'd he find?
He finds a shadowy, highly organized collective of independent radio promoters known in the industry simply as The Network.
Now, historically, record labels always hired independent agents, right?
Right, sure.
You'd hire a guy in Chicago to buy a radio programmer a steak dinner and pitch the new single. That was just standard business.
It was, but Asher realized this practice had metastasized. The consolidation of these promoters into The Network turned standard promotion into a toll booth.
A toll booth?
By 1980, these network promoters had a vice grip on radio program directors across the country.
Wow.
They were charging the major labels anywhere from $100,000 to $300,000 per song just to guarantee it got added to radio playlists.
That's absurd.
It was costing the industry as a whole up to $80 million a year. And Columbia, being the biggest label, was footing a massive chunk of that bill.
So what does this all mean? If Dick Asher, the meticulous lawyer, can plainly see on a balance sheet that these independent promoters are bleeding the label dry to the tune of tens of millions of dollars during a severe financial crisis.
Yeah.
Why was Walter Yetnikoff, the aggressive, glass-shattering president, vehemently defending them?
That's a great question.
The research shows Yetnikoff literally called these promoters mensches in public. Why defend the people taking your money?
This raises an important question, and it's the exact realization that chilled Dick Asher to the bone.
Okay.
Asher realized this wasn't promotion anymore, it was extortion.
Oh.
The network didn't just have the power to get songs played on the radio. Their true terrifying power was their ability to completely prevent songs from being played if a label dared to bypass them and not pay their exorbitant fees.
Oh, wow.
Yetnikoff defended them because he was terrified of what would happen if Columbia stopped paying the tribute money.
Which brings us right back to our opening hook. Mm-hmm. It's 1980. Pink Floyd releases Another Brick in the Wall. The song is a massive, organic smash hit. It has incredible momentum. And Dick Asher decides this is the perfect moment to run a covert test.
He draws a line in the sand.
He refuses to pay the network for this specific song. His logic is sound, right? The song is a cultural phenomenon. The band is actively selling out massive arenas in Los Angeles. The local radio stations will have to play it regardless of what the independent promoters say.
But they didn't.
They didn't.
The moment Columbia stopped paying the fee, not a single major radio station in Los Angeles would program the record. A complete eerie blackout.
That is just terrifying.
The network was flexing its muscles, proving to the entire industry that even a band as titanic as Pink Floyd could be entirely erased from the airwaves if the label didn't pay the toll.
And reading Asher's memos from the time, he wasn't just worried about losing record sales on a Pink Floyd album.
No, the stakes were much higher.
The true terror was the Federal Communications Commission.
Exactly. As a media lawyer, Asher saw the writing on the wall. He knew this extortion racket was dangerously close to organized crime, and it absolutely reeked of illegal payola.
Yeah, pay for play.
If the SEC launched a formal investigation and determined that CBS Records was complicit in a massive, multi-million dollar pay for play scheme, the government wouldn't just fine the record label.
What could they do?
They had the power to revoke the broadcast licenses for the entire CBS television network.
Oh my God.
The corporate stakes were astronomically high.
It is a stunning realization when you step back and look at the whole picture here. The journey we've just taken proves it's almost hard to believe it's the exact same company.
It really is.
Columbia Records started out peddling someone else's fragile wax dictation cylinders in Delaware.
Yeah.
They barely survived the absolute economic devastation of the Great Depression by clinging to regional gospel radio.
Right.
They literally invented the modern vinyl LP format simply because an executive was too comfortable on his couch to flip a shellac disc.
Uh-huh, basically.
And then, a few decades later, they find themselves locked in a shadow war, fighting mafia-like radio blackouts over a Pink Floyd song just to protect a television network.
It is a narrative of constant, forceful reinvention. They didn't just sign talented artists. They actively dictated the physical medium those artists recorded on.
Yeah.
They controlled the logistical distribution of the music, and they wrestled with the invisible gatekeepers of the airwaves. Every single time the economy collapsed or the underlying technology shifted, Columbia had to violently pivot just to survive the next decade.
Which leaves you with something really profound to consider. Think about your absolute favorite album right now. The one you know every single word to.
Everyone's got one.
How much of what you love about that album was shaped by the artist's pure, unadulterated talent? And how much of it was secretly dictated by the physical limitations of the formats they were forced to record on, or by the invisible, highly paid gatekeepers deciding if you were ever allowed to hear it in the first place?